In March of 1772, Franklin grew frustrated and angry. At age 66, he was already exhausted by the mundane tasks of his daily routines and feared his opportunities to achieve his goal of freedom for Pennsylvania were slipping away. The crown was clearly not going to wrench his province from the hands of the hated Penn family, and Parliament was simply disinterested in the matter. Any consideration of manumission of American slaves appeared exhausted. The crown enjoyed the fruits of slave labor to bolster its global economy and was not going to move to upset that delicate balance of relative immorality for relative wealth. And Parliament was not inclined to make any movement to end slavery in Great Britain and was not empowered to press toward manumission in the colonies. It truly appeared that Franklin's efforts had reached an impasse. He was staring up a blind alley, and there were no doors to enter. One night, at a dinner meeting of the Inner Circle in late March, his anger overflowed and he lashed out.
Just one slave, and perhaps we could still build this.
Dr. Franklin, this simply cannot happen. We have tried everything. We have made a noble effort toward your goal, and we simply have exhausted our remedies. I have nothing further to suggest.
Pownall and Franklin sipped their ale. Clearly, they had already identified a potential motivation for the plantation owners in the southern British colonies to join the cause of Massachusetts in separation from the crown. The letters were waiting in Benezet's school in Philadelphia. The ensuing silence was pervasive, and almost everyone present fell victim to their despair. But then a voice from the other side of the table.
Dr. Franklin, thou hast said one. Is that correct?
It was the naturally tremulous, timid, but eloquent voice of John Fothergill.
Pray go on, doctor.
Well, there is a man here in London that may be able to deliver thee but one, manumitted.
What? How?
There is a man named Granville Sharp, a mirror of thine own Anthony Benezet in Philadelphia, but more legally inclined, an Anglican, working steadfastly, but so far unsuccessfully, at legal manumission through the courts.
Now Franklin sat upright, intrigued.
Yes, I've heard of this Sharp, but have yet to meet him. All the same, I am aware of dear Benezet and his efforts for unfree persons and Native Americans in Philadelphia. He works to support them and to educate them, but certainly has neither the inclination, nor the resources, nor the background to pursue legal remedy in the colonial courts. It would be difficult to conceive of a like-minded individual here in London who would have a better chance of it.
Fothergill gently contradicted him.
But it seems that Sharp is something of a self-taught solicitor, and an exceedingly bright and talented man. He has appropriated for himself an extensive knowledge of English common law, and now has the ear of a key jurist on the King's Bench. They are said to be working together quietly to identify the case that will reveal to all Great Britain the immorality and failed social contract of human slavery.
Franklin slumped down again, demonstrably skeptical.
There is no such jurist on King's Bench. They are all sworn to adjudicate their cases in support of the crown, serving as agents of the king, as they understand their role on the bench.
Ah, yes, Dr. Franklin, that is true. But there is one.
And pray tell, who is this enlightened jurist of yours, Dr. Fothergill?
None other than the Chief Justice, Lord Mansfield.
The room fell silent.
But I must implore thee, humbly, Dr. Franklin, do not attempt to contact, far less intervene with Sharp at this point. He works in the shadows of Mansfield, much as we honest Whigs work with thee, and at the first signs of disturbance is forsworn to abandon his mission, and will, as he is a quite moral and upright individual. In thy zeal thou couldst readily accomplish quite the opposite of thy stated goal. Pray, let him work in secrecy.
I trust you will be able to keep us apprised of his progress in this mission, Fothergill?
Only as much as I am able. He is a very quiet and thoughtful man.
Franklin looked straight at Fothergill. Once again, he had to trust, and he so dreaded this dependency. But this was all that was left, and he simply had to press on, entrusting to a stranger and an obscure young barrister the entire success of his revolutionary plan.
Shall we press on, Dr. Franklin?
Franklin responded blankly,
We have no other option, Pownall. Where do we stand in the colonies?
There is currently a likelihood that Parliament, having rescinded the Townsend levy, will initiate a new taxation on the surplus British tea burgeoning daily in our warehouses and ports, in so doing to leave a symbolic levy to assert Parliament's ability to further assess levies on the colonies, and at the same time to unload the excess tea upon the reliable American market. My God, how your people drink the stuff. The behaviour in the colonies in response to the stamp tax and the Townsend levies have not been soon forgotten, nor forgiven, by many of my colleagues.
And what, pray tell, will retention of a symbolic levy accomplish in Boston and Philadelphia?
Parliament desires to remind the colonials of their position and their subservience to their monarch, and will hear of no other stance in this regard. I anticipate that this will indeed be the outcome of the pending legislation now in the Commons.
Franklin eased back, thoughtful, and then smiled.
Samuel Adams will have his day on this one.
Franklin was not a born revolutionary. That indisputable designation fell to two men in Massachusetts, both named Adams and both living in Boston, but no more closely related than second cousins.